CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, if you'd like to introduce our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today's show is sponsored by Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, the SAP Business by Design solution is a single integrated business management solution that delivers the best of SAP software on demand, offering the benefits of larger applications without the need for a costly IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News, earlier this year, Deloitte issued its white paper, Finance Transformation, Think, a la carte, not overhaul. The demands of the finance organization have and will continue to expand. Finance itself needs to grow in focus, capabilities, as well as contribution, if it is to meet the imperative to add business value while fulfilling its increasingly complex roles and responsibilities. Through their work with global organizations, Deloitte has identified 10 key finance transformation challenges facing CFOs and finance organizations today, and they've also addressed the strategies to address them. Understanding these challenges and adopting proven strategies can help finance fulfill the expanded role and responsibilities it has at the executive table. And briefly speaking, these 10 key finance transformation challenges are: 1, going global, how to manage the finance operating model. 2, how finance earns its stripes, improving business decision support. 3, prioritizing capital investments. It's not as easy as 1, 2, 3. 4 is finance is not a concierge service. Do less and still be valuable. 5, tax, the rock stars of the bottom line. 6, financial risk management from intelligence to action. 7, regulation changes are coming. Do not be afraid. Embrace the opportunity. 8, finance talent management. It's not an on-off switch. 9, if cash is king, how come no one else seems to care? And 10, prioritizing finance transformation investments. Realistically, the Deloitte report indicates that finance cannot address all these challenges at once. For more on the Deloitte complete paper, please go to Finance Transformation Think a la carte, not overhaul on the Deloitte website. Well, today, Mark White joins us to discuss the role of the CFO. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Mark, you are the Executive Chief Financial Officer of SAP America. Previously, you held a number of positions with the company, including Chief Operating Officer of Business Operations for SAP Americas, where you were responsible for the company's shared service organizations, including Value Engineering, Solution Engineering, Industry Solutions, as well as Sales Operations. And prior to joining SAP Americas, you were the Senior Vice President and Corporate Controller at Lucent Technologies, responsible for the annual financial plan and quarterly forecasting, internal and external reporting and SEC filings. Additionally, you've held responsibility for the senior finance managers within Lucent's operating divisions. Now, you've held various financial as well as operational management positions, both domestically and internationally, including Europe, and while you were working at Cadence Design Systems and Unisys Corporation. So we're very thankful to have you today, Mark. You have a substantial history and experience. In your current role, you oversee finance for SAP America. Tell us a little bit about how you got here, your background and your earlier career, and what made you choose the path that you're in today?
Well, again, thank you for allowing me to join this conversation. And in terms of that specific question, choosing this path, it goes back, obviously, to college. Really, as I took various business classes at university, and talk to different professors and different corporations that would come on campus to give a presentation. I just sort of gravitated to finance because I thought it was one area that kind of reached across all the organizations of companies. Obviously, if you're in sales, you tend to be in that somewhat narrow niche. Same to a certain degree with marketing, although I did take a lot of classes in marketing as well, and actually majored, had a double major in that. But when it came down to it, I gravitated towards finance just because I liked the breadth of the exposure that you could get across a company, that you could touch every different operating aspect within a company, as well as, of course, help shape its business model in terms of ultimately its revenue growth and profitability. So it really all began back at university level.
Interestingly enough, many of the people in marketing have a decision in their career to follow the numbers that they are helping to sell through their marketing programs, or perhaps to stay and be that marketing person. You made the leap. The finance was a lure for you. You went to the grass is greener on the other side, huh?
Absolutely. And, you know, I really enjoy spending time with the marketing people. It's a little harder to connect sometimes the efforts of what they do to actual results. You certainly can see it in terms of pipeline growth. And when you follow that pipeline ultimately all the way through to the final contract with a particular customer, or you can look at it in terms of brand awareness and increase in brand value. But I thought it was, in terms of finance, I just liked being able to make more of the connection of marketing to sales to services, to different annuity streams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, your background has given you, I think, a very, very solid base, and certainly very unique compared to our other guests. You've had some operational roles in a variety of different aspects outside of finance. That often has an impact in terms of viewing that operations. When you come into the finance function, you're able to take on elements of change and transformation. And that's certainly something you've done at SAP America. Over the five-year period, you were instrumental in leading a key transformation that resulted in revenue growth, as well as an increase in the operating margin rate. Among other responsibilities, you've led the transition team for acquisition integration. What I'd like to do, Mark, is to talk a little bit about the CFO role. Often you're not only looking at what companies you would like to acquire on the pursue end, but you're also looking at the role of integrating the companies post-acquisition. Maybe tell us a little bit about the lessons you've learned from acquiring companies and how you integrate the people, process, and systems.
Yeah, there's, you know, I was involved in a lot of integrations, both overseas in Europe as well as back here in the United States. And in terms of lessons learned, you really have to show to the employees of the new company, and I'm going to start with employees first, that the management teams of both companies are absolutely aligned that this was the right decision for both companies in terms of combining them together. Whether you're the acquired company or you're the company buying them, you have to show that the management team is absolutely aligned. And the best way to do that, actually, I believe, starts in the back office area, and it's often led by finance, and then you drag along to a certain degree IT with it. You have the HR people right at your side, the people from human resources talking about the employee programs, the benefit programs, the compensation programs, talking about the new company policies they might have to operate under and how we're going to transition them from perhaps their IT systems to our IT systems. And obviously in the case of SAP, given the breadth and the capability of SAP applications, any company that SAP acquires is going to come onto SAP applications. So right away, you've got to get with that management team and show that the reason for the acquisition and how you're going to transition all these employees over, both from a system standpoint, benefit standpoint, company policy standpoint. They're obviously going to be somewhat concerned about their jobs because obviously in nearly every acquisition, there are savings in addition to top-line revenue synergies that you're trying to achieve. So the earlier you get to that conversation, the better off you are as well. And that is a very key lesson. You can't leave people dangling out there because rumors will take over. Rumors are often very negative. They're rarely very positive. And you've got to provide certainty to the employees as soon as you can. Let's flip now to customers. So customers, obviously, you want to retain those customers. In fact, the whole reason for an acquisition is generally to grow your footprint in the current customer base, as well as expand your capability with other customers that may be looking, potential customers that may be looking at now this very powerful combined company. And so that's where your marketing actually really takes over probably the most, if I could go back to marketing, and the value of the brand and the combination. So the marketing message is to really the, in some cases, the technology-related reasons behind the acquisition, or they can be financial reasons if you're buying a company because of their recurring revenue stream. But generally, there should be a technology or product reason for the acquisition. And so the marketing engine needs to take over very quickly as well to reach out to all those potential new customers as well as your existing customers and explain the rationale for the merger or the acquisition and explain why this is going to be better for them as well as start reaching out to potentially new customers to explain why it should be better for them. The sooner you do that, the better you are because the longer there is a period of uncertainty, the more you have an opportunity for competitors to come in and gain a foothold or for your own customer base to wonder, well, what does this mean for me? Are they really going to leave me behind? The things that I like about doing business with them, is that no longer important? Or just exactly what this is this going to mean? So key lessons learned. Number one is remove the uncertainty as soon as possible, both from the employee perspective as well as the customer perspective.
Well, taking that one step further, Mark, you've talked about removing risk. A key element now that you, let's say, we've integrated the newly acquired company, and essentially we're now just kind of trucking along. We have added sales, added customers, added employees, and added processes. And you've gone through a transformation, and you're essentially streamlining so that you now have a one process, one system, or at least an integrated process. So now, when you look at risk and risk management, you are a publicly traded company, and as we look at risk and taking that in adopted fashion for the finance world, one of the biggest risk changes that we've had for the last, I guess, 10 years, and some might say through time, has been the enactment of Sarbanes-Oxley. As you integrate these people process systems, you have to make sure that they are compliant with your current SOX requirements. Please, if you can, share your thoughts regarding SOX and the CFO and through that whole process of transformation.
Well, I have two thoughts on SOX. And one is not a positive comment, and the other is. So I'll start with the negative first. And I remember, you know, talking to Congressman Mike Oxley, actually, who was a co-sponsor, obviously, of the bill, although Paul Sarbanes probably did 90-95% of the work, but they needed a sponsor in the House as well. But in terms of actually preventing, let's say, inaccurate public reporting, and if you're if you want to say it as strongly as fraud, but I won't say it as strongly as that. I'll just keep it at perhaps
misstatement.
Not having to, Pardon?
Misstatement or error. Misstatement. What is it? Frauds and irregularities.
Right. So if you look at the history since Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, Sox did not prevent Lehman Brothers from failing or Merrill Lynch from nearly failing and all the other issues, in the, particularly the financial services world that we've gone through with the mortgage crisis and the collapse of the housing market and the big problems within Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and ultimately bankruptcies of Chrysler and General Motors. So for those people who thought that Sox would be able to provide a set of controls and a framework for companies that would lead ultimately to better reporting and for public information so that informed investors could avoid making bad investments and that companies would not fail. Because if you look at Lehman Brothers, you can certainly say someone in that company must have known the trouble they were heading for, but yet their public comments prior to that, over the previous 6-9 months, prior to their failure, was they were going to be okay. So on the negative front, Sox really has not prevented that, and I doubt that it will prevent it in the future. Now, on the positive side, I think for many, many companies, it's actually led to a tremendous amount of efficiency gains because companies were forced to standardize policies, particularly if they were global multinational companies. They were forced to try to standardize policies, systems, applications, processes because the documentation required and the testing required in all these different locations or legal entities was so costly that it forced them to become more efficient, forced them to make some hard decisions about the future direction of their company from a policy and process and infrastructure standpoint. And I think that's been all very beneficial in terms of providing real-time information and a better control environment for which to manage risk.
And I guess at this point, most, all companies, if they haven't got over the hiccups of the administration burden, it should be routine at this point.
Yeah. Now, so, you know, I'll bring up a topic you probably didn't expect me to bring up on this call, which is for those people listening in, for those of you who read the papers, you know that SAP's just been hit with a $1.3 billion verdict in a recent lawsuit, Oracle versus SAP. And that goes back to our previous discussion on acquisitions. So, and lesson learned from that very expensive mistake by SAP is that you can't just acquire a company and kind of leave it off to the side. You have to have good controls over it from a SOX perspective, from a risk management perspective, and you can't assume just because it's a different legal entity that that is going to protect you from whatever misdeeds and process errors are done within that acquisition. SOX can help you there if you apply SOX correctly, but if you don't, you can get very badly burned by it.
Well, that being said, a role of SOX that you've talked about is controls and controls integration. But being that you are a systems company, a software company, is the role of SOX any easier with an integrated system?
Oh, absolutely. When we first started our documentation process and testing of controls, we began in Germany, followed quickly by the United States. We actually wanted to start in our bigger subsidiaries. I know some other companies decide to begin in, let's say, less significant parts of their business because they didn't want to cause disruption and they had to make decisions regarding change. They wanted to see how it would work in a smaller unit. But in our case, we started in Germany, followed quickly by the U.S., and when it came to documentation and of our policies and processes, basically it was about 95-96% the same in Germany as it was in the United States because we do have an integrated system. And, of course, the changes were really because of different tax laws more than anything else, slightly different benefit plans. But in terms of the company expense policies and so forth, and how we record that within the system, how we test it, how we document it, that was all the same, and having an integrated system was a big, big benefit to us. When they first came out with all these estimates about how costly SOX would be when it was first being implemented, in the case of SAP, it came nowhere close to approaching that because of the integrated system.
That's fabulous. That's certainly a great lesson learned. We have many CFOs on the show that perhaps their companies have gone through transformation, M&A activities, and one of the key differentiators that I hear as you leading the company here in the for America is that you're requiring an integration onto your standard system. I myself have come through the thought process of that being best practice, but of course not everybody has the funds and the time to be able to support that movement, and so sometimes Excel on drugs or some kind of a consolidation may be the path to go post-acquisition, certainly from the initial outset. So I very much support your role in terms of integrating those systems.
Yeah. What we really strive for, if our system is completely integrated and really working correctly, is, of course, and this did happen about now 5 years ago, we were selling a part of the campus basically in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania, and there was a tremendous amount of accounting that had to go on behind that because there was a synthetic lease and there were multiple stages to it, and someone made a data entry error. And at corporate, we had forecasted, we thought that this amount was going to be a hit to the P&L, $500,000. And instead, someone slipped in an extra digit, and it was $5 million. And within 30 minutes, we got a note back from corporate saying, this doesn't make any sense. What was your forecast wrong? Of course, it was just simple data entry. And because it was one standard system and everyone sees the same number dependent upon delegation of authority, we were obviously able to go in and make that journal entry change.
That's fabulous. 30 minutes to identify that magnitude of error is quite unbelievable. There's probably a lot of CFOs listening and maybe even CEOs that wish they had the same systems. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Well, SAP, obviously, we're talking about you and your company and the products and the software that you sell. You are known as the software company that not only develops large-scale ERP solutions, and I'm very familiar walking through the airports. I see the sign and the logo, the best-run companies use SAP. Our listeners, however, may not be very familiar with the smaller product, such as Business by Design and other solutions that you have in place for small companies. Let's take a little bit, if you can, and tell us about your company's expansion into this area. And we've talked about customers, we've talked about sales and marketing. Why have you developed solutions for the smaller company?
Well, if you look at SAP's goals, let me just start at a high level, and then I'll drop down to that specific question, is our mission statement is to make the world run better. And we actually believe today there are more transactions processed through SAP applications on a daily basis than any other company in the world. And so when you make that statement, people say, well, yeah, that makes some sense. Apple runs on SAP, ExxonMobil, General Motors, Ford, and they concentrate on all the biggest companies in the world, BMW, Mercedes, Shell, Johnson & Johnson, et cetera, Colgate-Palmolive, Procter & Gamble. You could go on and on. So they think of just the big companies. We have about 140,000 customers globally in about 130 countries around the world, and that's excluding Sybase, which we've just completed the acquisition on. But the majority of our customers are not just those Fortune 1000 customers that seem to dominate the headlines. The majority of our customers are small and medium-sized business, And we have been developing applications for the small, medium-sized business for several years, some of them being known as A1, otherwise known as All-in-One, and then Business One. So very specific applications targeted to small and medium-sized businesses that, in the case of All-in-One, is kind of just a shrink-wrapped version of the SAP Business Suite. So now we have a new technology that we've developed called Business by Design. And that is a that's an integrated business management solution that will allow basically smaller size, but mid-sized companies, larger size companies, perhaps they want a subsidiary to use it within a larger company, could also use it. And what it does is it's really the business suite on an on-demand basis. So it runs the gamut from financials, products, helps you in compliance, business intelligence, everything in an on-demand environment with a per-user pricing model behind it. Very different than what SAP has done in its past with its, let's say, business suite model. And the other thing I'd like to say, just going back to the high end again, is people still think of us as an ERP company. Actually, our business intelligence products are nearly, in terms of what we're selling today, are nearly as big as ERP. So our acquisition of Business Objects certainly gave us the leadership position in business intelligence and business analytics. We've kind of tried to take all of that knowledge and know-how and put it in now into this business by design solution. And so as long as you have access to the internet to access business by design, you're good to go. You don't need any additional software. You don't need any additional hardware. So it's very much like the other on-demand solutions being offered, but it's much broader in its scope of application capability.
Well, let me jump ahead a little bit, if I can, and we perhaps should talk a little bit about what that means on demand. I think you're referring to cloud computing architecture. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. As a CFO, does it scare you that your employees are accessing the internet to be able to prepare a journal entry, or is that actually an additional control because of the controls that SAP puts in place?
Well, based on what we've done in terms of security, and you know, with this whole WikiLeaks thing that has just gone on, and in response to that, I think I saw it was a 15 or 16 year old person in either Belgium or the Netherlands who then was able to hack into Visa and MasterCard. People obviously have a reason to review the security aspects of an on-demand offering.
And they really should go hire these 15, 16-year-olds to go help them implement the controls, right?
I got to tell you, I was pretty surprised when I saw the age of the person. I really thought it would be someone a little older than that. I was sort of expecting a college-age student or someone under the age of 30. But 15 to 16 kind of blew me away. But, I guess I just kept thinking, why isn't the person in school? But anyway, in terms of the security aspects, you haven't heard so far any company that has an on-demand cloud-based computing offering having a breach of their security. Salesforce, when it was going through early ramp-up, rapid growth, probably now 3 years ago, might be 4 years ago, had these periods where their network was overwhelmed by usage, and so their network would go offline. That was not a security issue, and their whole issue was, well, they need to buy more. They didn't think from a risk-based perspective, what do we need from an infrastructure perspective to make sure our customers don't experience any outage. So in the case of SAP, we have very capable partners who will help us with that. And security is something we take very seriously. And I don't anticipate any breaches. And I think for a CFO, when you look at our business by design offering, and you see how easy it is to use, And I've had demos. I've gone down. I've met with the team and had them give me demos of it. It is really easy to use, very intuitive, because in the past, SAP was criticized in its business suite for having a very poor user interface, and it was difficult to use, difficult to learn. But once you learned it, it was great. This is really easy to use. It's right at your fingertips, and I don't think there's any security concern, and it has such a breadth of functionality, which other on-demand offerings do not still offer.
And they're really
niche providers still.
And to your point in terms of security, very often small run companies don't have the funds to put in the level of security or the level of backups or any kind of network infrastructure that a company such as you or any of the other cloud computing product firms do. So it probably does give them a step up from where they are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I like our A1 solution. I like our B1 solution as well. But I think this is just a much, much better solution now for small and medium-sized businesses, or even for large companies who want to, you know, maybe they've just acquired a company and they want to migrate them. I think this is a better alternative for them because it's so easy. It's so quick. It's got great functionality. I'm not a big believer in customization. I think customization is a very bad word. I believe customization should only really be in two things. One is the people that you allow access to certain levels of data, and two, the type of reporting that you do. So that's the customization I believe in. I don't believe in, you know, that companies operate so vastly differently. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter if their businesses, you know, what they're selling is different or the market they're serving is different. At the end of the day, the income statement and cash flow statement, receivable statement, all the things that drive from that, that really isn't that, it really shouldn't be that different to enter the data, extract the data. What is different is what type of data do you want to have as your key performance indicator and how do you want to track that, monitor that. So for me, the customization comes around the type of reporting that you want to do and who has access to it. And our business by design solution, the reporting is so quick, so easy. And, you know, as you mentioned, there's no hardware investment. There's no software investment that you have to make. There's just a monthly fee that you pay for on a per-user basis to have this capability at your fingertips.
And I apologize, but I'm sitting here kind of smiling and giggling on my end. 25 years ago, I had a one-year contract where I implemented from a System 36 to a System 38 with six modems. And I was one of the people that actually went to the software developer and told them their trial balance didn't balance. And they didn't believe me, but I proved it. And so we've come full circle. 20-plus years ago, there was no capability for customization because that just we were in the beginnings. The inertia was not yet there. Then we went into a whole world of customization is, you know, great. And now we're looping back to, you know what, there's a reason that the software development company designed it that way. It has good controls. Go with the flow, change your process. And there's a difference of attitude in terms of perhaps the product that you choose versus the culture of the company of everything needs to be customized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely agree with what you just said.
Apologies for my little self-reflection there. But have you seen your role as CFO change over time? We're talking about a lot of IT functions here. Is the role now much more of a CFO, CIO?
Well, you mentioned, you know, when you introduced me, my level of operating experience. That is something I recommend to everyone because I think if you want to better understand the motivations and what excites people and what kind of discourages people that are out in what I'll call the field, so whether they're in sales or services, implementation services, maintenance support, if you want to understand their motivation, I actually think it's better to be an effective CFO to have held one of those management jobs and have absolute accountability for P&L. And so in terms of role CFO, it has changed tremendously. So if I could go back to that lawsuit, you know, I was the one that SAP asked to go in and, in a sense, clean up the mess from the day that the lawsuit was filed. And, you know, I'd had some previous experience in a support organization, some previous experience in a services organization, but I certainly don't have the technological depth of experience to write code and to write bug fixes and to provide updates, et cetera, that these people had in that business. But as a CFO, sometimes you're asked to go in and do things that are well beyond what finance is. And I think if you've had an operating role before, you're better for it. So in terms of what I'm doing now internally with my people is anyone who wants to really progress through promotion to eventually replace me or perhaps go higher to the global CFO role for SAP globally, I'm saying you need to either go through revenue recognition because it's so important now to companies. You have to go through there for 1 to preferably 2 years as part of your career growth, and preferably you also have to go through a pricing organization because through a pricing organization, you'll understand, you'll work, and in both of those positions, you work directly with the sales force, whether they're selling software, whether they're selling services, you work directly with them. You understand how customers want products packaged together, what motivates salespeople, what motivates customers. You'll get a little bit of a insight into the final contracts as well, and I think it's just great experience for when you then go on to perhaps do forecasting or reporting, business operations. So if you go through those two, I think it sets a foundation. Preferably, you've also will have a operating position for at least 1 to 2 years as well, where you're actually driving the P&L as opposed to, in a sense, feeling like you're just measuring it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a phenomenal insight, and I think very, very good and well said words in terms of those listeners today that perhaps desire to have your role or a similar role in some future time period. Well, as we look at that and take that growth that you've been talking about, SAP is a worldwide international company, and much of the potential growth that we hear about that the US is going to experience in the next decade is quite likely to come from those international markets. You've talked about small run companies, what I might refer to as a, you know, basement business. Even those small run companies today may have the complexities because of selling into a financial and foreign market. They may have complexities of foreign exchange, hedges, swaps, foreign currency. What do you think that this role has had absent that, the controller or CFO may really be much along the lines of a bookkeeper in a small run company, yet it's got a lot of complexities. What do you think that all these elements have had as an impact on the role of the CFO?
Oh, I think it's enormous. I think the CFO, I mean, you really have to be, someone said this a few years ago when I was in a different company, you know, to a certain degree, you have to be the safe pair of hands for a company. And by that, I mean you have to be the person that everyone in the company can rely on in terms of if they've got a problem, if they've got an issue, they know they can go to you. So, you know, while here at SAP, you know, I mentioned this Tomorrow Now acquisition that the company turned to me to figure out what to do with it. Now, the outcome of the lawsuit wasn't so good, but ultimately, the company asked me to do 4 things, and I did all 4 things. And I never expected I'd have to give up my CFO role to do that. But within SAP, I've also, you know, when there's been some issues with customers, generally the sales force or the services organization will come back to me you know, to be the sounding board. And it's not because they just want to say, okay, what's the P&L impact going to be for this? They want to know that they have my support in how to proceed based upon my experience. And so whether you're in a large company, middle-sized company, or a small company, if you're handling the finances of those companies, you really have to have an understanding of what's going on operationally. I know there's a few companies, there's still this belief that, well, the finance person is delivering the bad news, so it must be a bad finance person. Well, it's all because of operational cause and effect, right? So if as a finance person, you can help the people out in the field shape the results and deliver better results, you're going to be really pleased with the numbers. But to do that, you've got to get invested with them. So you've got to understand what's going on in their marketplace and the challenges they're facing. You're not just worried about the latest change in U.S. GAAP or IFRS or pension accounting and the tax law changes at the state or local or federal level or just hedge swaps. You really need to understand what's going on in those markets. What are the operating people trying to achieve? So finance cannot be narrow. It just cannot be narrow. It has to be really, really wide.
What do you think is that key challenge for, let's say, you as a public company, CFO, in today's international environment? Is it coming from the human capital side, the financial capital side, maybe governments, or is it something else?
Well, I think there's two. I mean, obviously, the most important challenge I think you have every day is on human capital side. Which is making sure you can attract the best talent, that you can motivate the best talent, you support them, and then obviously you want to retain them. Because if you have the best talent, then you have a better chance of making the best products, having the best relationships with customers, and having an integrated people community with inside your organization. So the competition for talent is always number one. Our biggest problem today, I think, in the world is what's going on at the government levels. I mean, there's too many governments that have let things go for too long. And so now we have a crisis in Greece. Now we have a crisis in Ireland and potential crisis in Spain or Portugal. Portugal's probably next. Belgium is actually pretty high up on the list. And at the same time, the U.S. continues to print an enormous amount of debt. And, you know, I'm not going to go into the politics of it. I'm just going to say it is really nasty, and I think everyone ought to prepare for scenarios where and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but scenarios, you have to think about what if America defaults on its debt at some point. And I hate to say that, but I think it's something you have to think about.
Well, that's quite a massive undertaking. Mm-hmm. And clearly, a company of your size perhaps has the capability to maybe be an advocate. But the average company, perhaps, that really isn't their concern. Or in terms of, yes, it is their concern, they don't have control over it. And so therein lies the big challenge that of what you're saying. It's really something where every day, every company is impacted, yet not necessarily, you can't move the mountain.
Well, you have to speak up, though. So when I go down to Washington, D.C., the congressmen that I meet with, they're always surprised because when they say, okay, why are you here? I go down there and I advocate on behalf of small and medium-sized business, particularly small. I have never gone down there and advocated on behalf of SAP, actually. I've advocated on tax changes and regulatory changes for small businesses because I know at the end of the day, they create more of the jobs. They eventually have a better chance to become a medium-sized business, whether through their own organic growth or a combination of acquisitions. And there's a lot of innovation, obviously, that occurs with that that would keep the U.S. in a leadership position as a country.
Absolutely.
So you've still got to speak up. You've got to let your voice be heard with your congressman, with your senator, whether at the state or federal level. It's as simple as writing a letter, as simple as making a phone call.
Well, that being said, let's go back to the number one concern that you had, and that being human capital. The U.S. is still experiencing some hard times. Some reports that we read say that we're out of the slump. Some reports say, hey, we're still at the bottom of the dip and we're not really moving up the curve. Let's talk a little bit about the organization and that human capital workforce. Has the challenges of the U.S. economy had any impact on you getting those good, strong, talented people to help you grow your organization?
I would say in 2010 in the United States, and I would extend that to Canada, so I'm just going to focus on North America. We were a company that was we resumed hiring earlier than other companies did. So I think we got a step up on being able to attract some good talent. Our turnover rate, probably much like other companies, has dropped during this weak economy because people want to keep the job they have as opposed to potentially moving someplace else. So if I look at our leadership team and sort of level one through level three managers, very, very little turnover. We recruited some very good people 5 or 6 years ago. That has continued through last year as well. And by last year, I'm referring now to 2010 since it's almost over. So we returned to hiring fairly early. We were able to keep our talent. We have a lot of focus in SAP on talent management. It's a big, big part of my job. It's a big part of every sort of level one and level two manager's jobs here. So the senior executives are very focused on it, and I would extend that globally. It's absolutely critical. I don't know what it means for next year. I saw in the Wall Street Journal today that cash balances at companies are at a record level because companies still don't see a compelling reason to invest, which kind of says it all when it comes to what they think about growth expectations for 2011 and 2012. But we see the opportunity to invest, we don't sit on our cash, we invest.
That, I think, is very much at play with the larger companies. And I think it is the larger companies that will help fuel some of that small company growth through the investments that you're discussing and through the acquisitions that we talked about maybe a little bit earlier.
Well, yeah, but, if I look at it right now, banks have nearly got their balance sheets in order. There's still some hanging out there. I know the list of problem banks is still roughly just under 1,000 in the U.S. But by and large, banks nearly have their house in order. Once they get approval to increase dividends back close to where they used to be in 07 and early 08, that's actually when I think they will start loosening up their lending standards. And that's probably the time that small and medium-sized businesses can return to the banks to get new sources of capital. I really have been waiting for banks to resume the dividends because I thought that was kind of the final step where they could say, okay, we're confident about the future of America. We're confident about being able to now talk to small and medium-sized businesses and help them get started and grow again. I really believe that until banks get to that last step, that you won't see loans go up still that high, and it's going to be hard for small and medium-sized businesses to expand. And then that's where Congress comes in. That's why I say write letters to them, because they've got to do something for small and medium-sized businesses. I don't know if it's – I always tell them lower corporate tax rates, job credits, so tax credits for jobs, all for small and even medium-sized businesses. And by medium, I'm defining it as anything of $200 million or below in revenue.
Well, I'm afraid, Mark, while I think I could talk for hours with you, this has been absolutely fabulous, and I really am thankful to have you on the show. I'm afraid we've come to the end of the show, but we have one last question. We do have a tradition on the show to ask our guests your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
Well, I guess I'll focus on people. I would tell you, spend... if you're a CFO, leadership position, spend at least 50%, ideally it's 70%, but 50% of your time with people, and make every moment that you have with them a teachable moment. You'll be surprised what people think about having FaceTime with you, or whether it's over the telephone, but try and spend more time with your people, and you'll gain their trust, they'll trust you. You'll get more certainty about your own position. You'll be a more effective CFO.
Well, that's a fabulous tip. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you to Mark White, our guest today, for sharing his innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thanks also go to our contributors and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. And thanks to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information on their products, please go to www.sap.com/SME. And thanks to Financial Executive International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is at financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know of a CFO who would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks to our guest, and thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.